Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of The Mirror Mall, our Six Nations podcast from the Daily Mirror. My name is Richard Innes, journalist at Mirror Online. I'm joined again by Gavin Allen, a Welshman and a fellow rugby-loving colleague. Is that fair enough to say?
I think that's probably fair.
That's probably fair, even though, of course, he's still licking his wounds from the weekend.
Loving it slightly less, I think.
And as ever, we are joined by our resident expert, Mr. Alex Spink, the Daily Mirror's Rugby Union correspondent. Hello, Alex.
Good morning, gents.
Good morning. Only one place to start this week, really, and that's at Twickenham, I suppose, because that really was the centrepiece of the whole weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, we talked about it last week, how tight we thought the game was going to be.
We got it spot on. Almost.
We did pretty much get it spot on. Yeah. We thought the Wales were going to make life very difficult for England, and they certainly did that. I mean, they brought their A game, frankly, given that they didn't bring their A team.
Yeah, A game from the B team. I'm not surprised how close they got to England on it, because I did think that was going to be the case. Mm. It's quite difficult for us to see where we are still, because after that relatively easy Scotland game,
yeah,
and we've now come into a game where we've been sort of, denied a try or here and there. You don't know how that game would have gone after that. Momentum was changing, would have made a difference, could have made a difference. Anyway, we still don't really know where we are, because if we'd have kicked on at that point and got a result like that match.
Well, I think Wales are in pretty good nick. Any team that comes to Twickenham in the foul conditions that they did, without nine of their headline players, concedes two penalties in the entire game, misses, I think the stat was, three tackles in the entire game. I mean, that's extraordinary performance. Yeah. You know, Gareth Anscombe's try should have been awarded. We'll talk about this a bit more in a minute. And then at the other end, one of the greatest tackles you will ever see in the history of rugby to deny Scott Williams a try at the other. I mean, that was an astonishing piece of play.
Absolutely outstanding. And we'll talk about the TMO thing later, but what I would say is that you can argue about the try all you like. The outstanding moments of quality in that game came from England, I think. I think Farrell's kick for Johnny May's first try was absolutely glorious.
Yeah.
And you can say the fullback wasn't at home, but he had to do it. You've got, that tackle.
Farrell, he is developing into a player who can really influence games big time. You know, even a game like that, in as much the sort of weather that they had, the sort of kind of chaos, the sort of drama and everything which goes with an England-Wales game, the kind of frenetic nature of it, he was still able to see things very clearly. You know,
that kick for Johnny May's try, in a weird sort of way, if he'd done that 3 minutes from the end, that would be lauded as one of, the great moves under pressure. It's almost like, because he did it after 3 minutes of the match, it almost got a little bit lost in what came afterwards. Yeah. But it was absolutely unbelievably brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And it comes from England getting their bits and pieces right. You know, they talked before the game about having to contest the high ball, the aerial game, getting their back three up, make every one of those aerial challenges, every one of those 50-50s, they wanted them to work their way, and they did. I mean, Wales had a shocker in the air. That try came about. Watson went up with Patchell, who'd been the focal point of Jones's kind of almost bullying, you'd say, in the previous week. Watson got the ball back. Farrell had the presence of mind to know that he had Johnny May, who's a seriously quick 10-point-whatever-second sprinter, on the left wing, and he knew that if he put it in that area, Josh Adams, who was making his first away game, away appearance for Wales in the Six Nations, or indeed anywhere, he knew he had a fair chance that if he put the ball on the money, May was going to deliver. And there you go, he does.
You mentioned Eddie Jones's various little bits of, I'm trying to think of the right word, shenanigans, perhaps the right word, in the build up and what he said.
Mind games, shenanigans.
It's like the old Sir Alex Ferguson thing in football, isn't it? It's this idea that you're getting into people. Given what we saw, do you think that actually had any effect, or is it all just a load of kind of media nonsense?
I think it did have an effect. I think two things. Most things he does is to influence his own team and the way that they think and the way that they believe and the confidence that is instilled in them by this guy who is, pretty damn good at it. You know, mm-hmm. he will go down as one of the great international coaches, and he's coaching this bunch of England players, and they still have hold him in that sort of awe. You know, there is an aura about him, and so when he tells them that he can turn water into wine, they buy into that. Mm-hmm. You know, and so when he decides in the week to have a go at Patchell, Rhys Patchell, the Wales fly half, who is a terrific player for the Scarlets, but he's relatively inexperienced, certainly at the top level. And when he decides to pick on him, as he did on one day last week, in a way which then carries on through the media for the rest of the week, he had a pretty good idea that not only would it get into Patchell's head, but it would also make England feel, you know, we're in a good position here, because he really believes that we're going to give it to him.
And they did go after him, didn't they?
And they did go after him. And, you know, I gave him 5 out of 10 in the rankings. I think that was probably about right in the player ratings afterwards. He had a difficult day. I think Wales were a lot more comfortable when Gareth Anscombe moved into the fly half position, albeit it was later in the game. But no, I mean, you'd have to chalk that up as a victory for Jones, whatever you thought about the morality of the way he went about doing it.
Do you know what? Speaking about morality, I'm going to jump straight in on something that wound me up a little bit. Mike Brown. Now, I'm sure Mike Brown's a lovely chap, and he's a very, very good rugby player. But when Scott Williams thought he'd gone in the corner and we had the brilliant try-saving tackle, there was an awful lot of people on social media that weren't very happy that Brown's first reaction was to get in Williams's face. And I don't think there's any doubt that he was goading him. He was kind of laughing at it. It was a bit of a wind-up. Now, admittedly, we've all played a bit of rugby. You know what happens. People say things on a rugby pitch. It didn't seem to be very much in the spirit of the game.
No, I think that's probably a fair point. Again, it ties into this whole sense that England are about winning. As opposed to the finer details. And Jones will make no bones about it that, you know, he's over here to make England a successful and a winning team. Now, other people would, like you have just pointed out, will say, yeah, well, there are ways of doing it. You don't need to rub people's noses in it. I know that Mike Brown is a Mr. Angry. It's a kind of self-proclaimed sort of persona that he brings to rugby. He's delightful company away from the rugby pitch, but when he gets on it, he is pretty in your face. That's the
Some
way
players
he does
need
it.
That, of course. You know, that's how you get yourself up to your level.
And he is a kind of Rottweiler in the England team, but that's why he's in the England team. So he's not going to get ticked off for that by anyone within the camp. And England won the game, and the haters will continue hating, and Jones will continue loving. And he's happy with that.
I don't think Mike Brown's ever been a popular man in Wales, and he's just gilded his lily there. He's just,
No holidays in Cardiff anytime soon for the Brown family, I don't.
I'm sure that's going to really knock him sideways.
I'm sure he'll be really gutted about that.
When you look at the Southern Hemisphere teams, when they play the Northern Hemisphere teams, England are consistently closer to those teams than Wales, Scotland, Ireland. And as much as I dislike the way that Eddie Jones went about targeting Patchell, I did say last week that I thought Patchell would have a different test against England before the, whether you want to call it bullying or not, but it's not nice. An international coach go after a less experienced player like that, knowing what's going to happen. I think then if you have a difficult start, then it gets into your head. I think if Patchell starts that game well, he kicks on and it probably doesn't bother him. But once it starts going backwards for him, then it becomes a problem.
Well, what's going to be fascinating now, Gav, is England go to Murrayfield next week to play your boys, Rich.
My boys,
I'm sure you're looking forward to.
Fresh from snatch, managing to sneak over a line, a game they should have won comfortably, but anyway.
But what's going to be fascinating is what strategy Jones adopts for Finn Russell, who's a Scotland fly half. Two games in, he's having a mare. Gets dragged off towards the end of the game against France, and they can play two scrum halves at halfback. Not exactly, the greatest kind of vote of confidence of all time. So what does Jones do now? Does he go for him in the way he's done Patchell, or does he big him up and say how great he is? You never know with Eddie Jones, because you just never know. You look at him, we go to press conferences and we ask him all manner of questions, and he will filter through them and he will know what he wants to talk about. And if the question doesn't come up that he wants to talk about, he will just introduce it into the conversation.
Do you get the impression when you're in those press conferences with Eddie Jones that he's already got his lines pre-prepared, that he knows what he wants to get out?
And I think that is the sign of the great coaches, that Clive Woodward always did the same thing, but on the journey he took England from a team which lost all the big games to winning the World Cup, he would develop this knack of always coming away from the press conference having got the message out that he wanted. It wasn't about what anyone else came. You know, we would sit there with reams of questions and ideas, and, oh, this might work, this might work. Woodward would come in and he would say it as it is. And Jones does the same thing. You know, he uses key kind of trigger words. Last week it was all about, we're going to hunt down Wales. Every press conference, we're going hunting. We're going to hunt them. It's great. You know, you're thinking in, as a journalist, you're thinking in headline terms immediately, oh, we're going to hunt them down. We're going to, you know, like this. And then all the players come in and they parrot the same thing. Mm. We're going hunting. Very clever.
So do you think they're briefed in that way?
Oh, yeah.
England players?
Oh, yeah.
So do you think it goes as far as Eddie Jones, you know, one of the initial team meetings when they first sit down to talk about the next fixture, he says, right, this is what I want, you know, and he's actually to the point of saying, these are the terms we're going to push.
Yeah, this is the theme for the week. This is what we're going to do. So Italy last year, we're going to batter them. We're going to give them a good hiding. These words keep reappearing then through the week. Mm. So you haven't got England players sitting in their five-star luxury, looking at the game and thinking, oh God, how's this going to pan out? Oh, we know how it's going to pan out because Eddie's telling us we're going to give him a hiding. Mm. And this is how we're going to do it. It's quite clever. You know, you can't play the same cards every week. It depends who you're up against. But Jones is very, very good at analysing the opposition and picking his targets. You know, he didn't go for Gatlin last week because he knows that Gatlin's a pretty smart cookie and Gatlin can play that game. Mm. So he went for Patchell. It was a far softer target, but come game day, come the 80 minutes that matter, he was a significant target.
It does sound very much like the sort of Fergie, Jose Mourinho type, because obviously we're more accustomed to that type of behaviour, those types of antics in the football world more than the rugby world.
And you talk to Jones about who he respects and who he admires. He doesn't talk about other rugby coaches. He talks about Jurgen Klopp. He talks about Jose Mourinho. He talks about particularly Antonio Conte. Loves the emotion, the passion that he brings to the game, what he's achieved down at Chelsea. Yeah, he is in awe of these football managers who are under the greatest pressure of all, day in, day out, front pages, back pages, and still are able to shape the destiny of their teams, both on and off the pitch. And, you know, you look at England in the 25 matches, I think it is now, since Jones came in at the start of 2016, he has shaped every conversation, every piece along the way. Whoever he brings into his 15, that 15 is moulded in the image of what he's trying to create that week. And, you know, at times you don't like some of the things he says, you don't like the way he goes for people, but when you look at it across the piece, you have to actually bow to it and think, actually, you know, he's pretty smart.
It's a results business, isn't it?
That's why I think that he won't, with Scotland, he's going to opt for praise and not going after it, because I think he's going to see Scotland as far less of a threat that he's not going to need to, after the criticism he's got on the Patchell thing. He's big enough and ugly enough, very ugly, to look after himself. But he's going to see that as people having a little go at him and his reputation, and he's going to think, I don't need to do that this week because Scotland made heavy weather of that against a fairly poor France side.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a hell of a game.
Yeah.
He points everywhere, tries everywhere, it was fantastic. But I think he's probably going to go for the Finn Russell soft soap.
And also, you don't want, you know, with Scotland, you want them feeling, you don't want them feeling like they're up against it, that there's a war going. You know, Scotland with their backs to the wall is actually when Scotland tend to come out. Whereas when Scotland feel that, you know, oh, this shouldn't be too bad, then that's when things tend
to fall apart.
If there's
one thing you as a Scottish fan, Rich, do not want to hear, it's England saying Scotland are actually dangerous.
Great, aren't they? Yeah.
They want arrogant England giving it to them.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they want.
Proud Edward's army. Yeah.
You can imagine. The crowd finds an extra voice and everything. But if Eddie Jones goes down the road, as he very well might now, of saying, actually, they were pretty good. They put France away, you know. This is going to be a dangerous one for us, and starts building up Scotland. Then the Scottish fans, you can hear them in the pub saying, "Oh, why doesn't he just shut up?"
I think that's already started. To be perfectly honest with you, I'd imagine. Do you know what? We can't move past Wales England without going back and talking about the moment. I'm sure Gav wants to talk about it at great length, and the TMO. I mean, Alex, you're a rugby expert, right? You know a lot more about rugby than I do. Why on earth was that try not given?
That is a question that pretty much everyone has been asking since the weekend. the one question in my mind is, does the TMO, the video ref, does he have exactly the same footage as has been shown around since then? If he, because A, he should have. And if he has, then to me it's inexplicable he didn't give it. It looked pretty clear that Anscombe got the first touch ahead of Watson. I've seen other people have claimed that, that Steph Evans got a slight knock on ahead of time. It didn't look that way to me. It looked as though it came off his shin. I can't understand why that trial wasn't given. There does seem to be a problem at the moment with this TMO because the decisions aren't always right, and you know they really should be. And when it comes to a case such as that one, I look also at the fact that it was a French ref. And they've flown the TMO in from New Zealand. Somebody else made this point, so I'm just nicking it from them, but it's a good one. Why not have the same TMO who, you know, in the same language, who deals with the same ref all the time?
I think that was Clive Woodward, actually. Agreeing with Clive Woodward for the first time in my life.
It's a decent point because at those moments, under that sort of pressure, you want to be talking with someone you're comfortable with, someone you understand. I mean, there seemed to be almost a language issue apart from anything else. I'm not sure the comms were working that brilliantly.
Yeah, there was a moment, wasn't there, where the referee said, I didn't understand you. Yeah. I couldn't hear you. There was something along those lines.
I think it was just I couldn't hear you more than anything else. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there was a language barrier involved in him seeing fairly clear pictures and not being able to make a decision based on them. I mean,
it must be about the downward pressure, right? Because surely the idea is he didn't have his hand on the top of the ball. He had his hand almost on the side of the ball.
Yeah,
it was a try, but I'm just trying to sort of play devil's advocate and think, well, what has he seen there?
If you were playing devil's advocate, for me, the only area of that is he gets his hand on the ball, he applies downward pressure. When the grounding happens, is his hand off the ball at that point? He might have applied downward pressure just slightly before the ball hit. That's the only thing I can see that he's looking at, because I think Steph Evans doesn't touch it on the way through with his hands. It's clearly a knee. There's clearly hand on the ball. There's clearly downward pressure. The ball is clearly grounded to me. I don't really get what Newman has seen, the TMO that he's unclear about.
Because it's clearly, the Steph Evans element of the supposed knock-on, that's a bit of a red herring, because that clearly wasn't what the decision was based on. The decision was based on the grounding.
Very quickly
and
dismissed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just moved through that. So I don't think that was an issue at all for them. So that's the only place I could see space for an argument.
A shame that these things come up, because they, you know, I was watching Super Bowl last week, and the NFL have had this rule or this change of interpretation now that when you go across for touchdowns, it's not just as simple as just breaking the plane as it used to be. You now have got to have all this control and complete the process. It's just complete nonsense. And you worry slightly with rugby, with a decision like that, which there isn't a person in the stadium who would have complained had that Wales try been given, because most people, you know, pretty much everyone thought it was a try. And now we're getting slightly caught up in some of these videos. We're waiting for a long time to watch them. It's a bit like the VAR in football, you know, that Liverpool game the other week.
It goes to show that the VAR in football and the TMO in rugby are not solutions within themselves, they're aids. As long as there are humans interpreting those aids, there will still be the room for human error, as you've seen.
There's going to be an element of subjectivity. I mean, I think on the basis that everyone else in the world seems to think it was a try, I think we can say the TMO got this one wrong, but there's always going to be that element of subjectivity.
Well, I still look at the 2007 World Cup final, England-South Africa in Paris.
Mark Huaito's
try. They decided that his left leg brushed against the touchline. I think it was his foot brushed against the touchline as he scored. Now, I've watched that. I still watch that video back, and I still can't see it. And it's nothing to do with being English. I mean, you watch it. Go on YouTube and watch it. All our listeners, watch it again and tell me where he touches the line, because I can't see it. But, you know, so the debate's all right.
Feel free to tweet, Alex.
Buzzing coming from under your bonnet there. What have you got under there?
Feel free to tweet, Alex, your thoughts on that Mark Huaito show, by the way.
Before we move on from that, I think the TMO argument will slightly overshadow the performance. Wales were in a place of momentum there. If that try goes over, the momentum changes. That doesn't say that we move on and we win the game, but it does change the game because it changes the way England play. England, to a degree, were trying to contain, I think, and counter. And if we'd got those points, then they would have moved into a different phase. Whether England had another gear to go up is debatable. I thought perhaps they did.
I think they probably were. I mean, I don't think England would have lost that game, but you don't know. We can debate about that.
The other things I would say is that the moments of quality in that game came from England, and it's not just Farrell's kick for May's try, it was Underhill's tackle on Williams, which it's just one of those moments of sport where you stand up and you go, wow.
Yeah, it didn't make sense, did it? It kind of defied the laws of physics to a certain extent, because when you saw Williams go in early, I think I immediately went, what are you doing? Because he'd been tackled. But actually, when you saw the replay back, you thought, well, that was entirely the right call, wasn't it? You know, sort of, you've got the wet pitch there.
Yeah.
Make use of it. Slide in. And I think I read it in one of your pieces from the weekend, Alex, about, I think it was Farrell's comment, that actually it was the fact that most people, you almost had just dive on top of the guy and then try and use your momentum, whereas what Underhill managed to do was somehow get under him
and then flip him, yeah.
Which is not a technique. I mean, as I say, I played a little bit myself. You'd never think about that. You just try.
Given that he'd fallen over earlier in the move and so was playing catch-up.
The ground he made up to get that. To get that angle on the run, because he came from 20, 30 metres behind. So to get side-on to that tackle was incredible.
And we were having this debate when we talked about it on Twitter yesterday about the kind of greatest tackles. And I've kind of said that is one of the all-time
great
tackles. The only difference being was that you know, I always put Joe Worsley's one very high in the 2007 semi-final.
Van Saint-Clerc in the semi-final. I went back and watched it again because I'd forgotten about this. So this is the tackle. Again, you'll need to go on YouTube, people, to see this. But it was the tap tackle, the ankle tap, as Clerc was basically in the corner, wasn't it? And wouldn't they have gone like 9 points clear at that point?
It would have won them the match,
and England wouldn't have made the final.
The host nation. It was really significant. And then I named a few others in my piece as well from down the years. You rightly came back with Josh Lucy. Matt Rogers one.
Yeah, although that wasn't a try saver,
but it was. I mean, there have been some great moments down the years, but I think that people should talk about that Underhill tackle for forever and a day, because I think it was a work of art in its own right. Doesn't matter whether he's English or whatever. I just think it was a special moment.
Exactly. I think given a few years to recover from the, you know,
devastating.
Then, you know, I think that'll be appreciated in Wales even. But one more is props to Launchbury for the handoff for Johnny May's second try, because if that had happened in Wales or New Zealand, that would have been you know, a piece of rugby ingenious played with a flair and spirit of the game. You know, it's like the Brazilians of football.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, you're quite right as well. If that was an All Black, then everyone would be falling over themselves. Oh, isn't it brilliant? Look at the handling skills of the All Black. Only in New Zealand could you get a front five forward who could do that, etc., etc.
It's one of those moments that shows the trust in your player. There is an element of luck to an offload like that. You need the man coming through, but you trust the man to come through. You know that someone's coming there to back you up, and you try it in an area like that. It shows guts as a player, and it was completed. And I just thought that, you know, there were a few moments like that for me, Farrell, that would they just lit up that game.
But when you've now got a team that can do that, you've got second row forwards offloading like that, you've got Mako Vunipola, who a lot of his ball skills wouldn't look out of place in the midfield. You've got a team like this, and all the time Jones is pushing the envelope on the skills and everything they're doing. This week he's flown Georgia in. In fact, where are we? Yes, they've arrived today. He's flown Georgia in, who are the 12th ranked team in the world, who've got the kind of biggest, as he says, ugliest scrum in the world. He's flown them in for 2 days of training. So England, they get to their fallow week completely banjacked by 3 weeks of hard work, and now they've got 2 days of live scrummaging.
In your experience, would you typically, when you get to one of these break weeks, would most teams have said, all right, we need to give the lads a bit of a rest here, there'd be a few days off, recover from some bumps and bruises, and then come back into training? is this really unusual to then sort of say, right, now this is where we're going to really push you?
It's not so much unusual with Jones, because he never gives up a moment. But I think the way the sport is going now, that it's not like some football teams, let's go to Dubai for the week and do a bit of, you know, warm weather training. You know, he has seen an opportunity with the scrum. He knows that for England to be at their gnarliest, most horrible best, and most effective come the World Cup, their set piece has to be what it is in folklore. England, you know, they can't play much rugby, but their forwards are going to beat you up every day of the week. And that's the way they've always been interpreted. So, and he came in, and while he wants them to be able to do the nice flicks and flourishes behind, the bedrock of England, of his England, still is to bully people at the set piece. Early this season, he agreed with Gatland that England and Wales would have a scrummaging session, which they did down in Clifton before Christmas one morning. He's now cranked that up to the next level. 2 days of live scrummaging with Georgia,
Did you hear anything about how that scrummaging session England v Wales went? Were there any stories?
No, I mean, a Christmas present to the Welsh pack.
Here's your chance. Have a free hit of the England pack. Yeah.
We went down there that day and it was done behind closed doors. All the press were banned, other than the fact they let in about 300 school kids with their mobile phones to watch it. Which slightly didn't quite stack up, but anyway, yeah, they did that, and no, we didn't hear an awful lot, and it didn't come across at the time as though it had been the most incredibly worthwhile thing of all time. But I think this will be this week.
But purely because I guess you wouldn't want to give away any tactical advantage, would you? If you're an opposition, you're
yeah, particularly if you're
each other and
yeah, particularly a Six Nations.
Yeah, I was going to say you're 2 months away from a Six Nations. Yeah. You're already going to be starting to formulate some ideas.
Whereas Georgia, as they don't need reminding, are not in the Six Nations, although they think it quite rightly.
Have you ever heard of an international team being, you know, and a decent international team at that? Like Georgia are no mugs.
No.
Have you ever heard of an international team being shipped in just to kind of help another team with their training?
Not for an element of the game like that. No, I mean it may well have happened. Whether any of the South Sea Islands go across to New Zealand to work with them, I mean, I don't know, but I could see that being
that might be possible,
more likely, but certainly not in this part of the world, no.
I know that, you know, the midway break for us is going to be a case of wrapping all our players in cotton wool and then bubble wrap and then putting them in a locked cupboard and then a Sabutio box and then then anything else you can get over them to just keep them fit where they are.
Well, what's going to be fascinating with Wales, Gav, now is whether they come away from that game and can use it as a springboard for the rest of the championship. You know, Gatland is saying, he leaves Twickenham saying, you know, we did pretty damn well. I'm pretty proud of you guys. Now, we're still in this championship. You know, it's entirely possible that England might lose to Ireland on the final day. Mm-hmm. England might lose at Murrayfield, who knows? But, i.e., don't give it up just because you've copped a defeat, you know. But in the players' minds, they've now got to go to Ireland. And then, yeah, I mean, Italy at home and then France at home. So if they can go to Ireland and get a result.
I completely agree. In terms of the messages that Gatland will be sending, if you wanted to put it in those terms, you would say, England are nowhere near as good as they think they are. They made a hell of a mess of beating our second side with 9 first teamers out.
Yeah.
And we got the referee against us. We should have won that game rightly. You'd not only feel proud, feel robbed, feel cheated, feel angry. Go into this Ireland game and show everybody what you're capable of. With new players coming back and the squad reinforced and big names there, let's go and do this. And if that happens, then I think you've got a different tournament. Ireland are the only team, realistically, you know, all due respect to Scotland. I can't see them beating England. I think Ireland can and possibly will. They're a very clinical team, put scores on the board. If Wales can fuel that reaction against Ireland, get the anger moving, get everything, get it all pointed in the right direction, we're still left with a hell of a tournament. It's not as easy as you win one game, you lose one game.
You're right, and Wales have turned up for both their games so far. You can certainly make a case that Ireland didn't really turn up in Paris the first game. You know, they won it through an extraordinary final 5 minutes. But you know, the French are pretty gutted to have let that one go. You know, Ireland couldn't get anything going as an attacking force that day.
And I suppose, given the way France kind of capitulated in the last 20 minutes against Scotland, apart from a late flurry maybe in the last couple of minutes, it maybe puts that result in Paris for Ireland into a bit more context.
I think so. I mean, Ireland were brilliant against Italy. They were brilliant.
Yeah.
But Italy weren't great, and Italy had been severely softened up by England the previous week as well.
Would it be fair to say that, you know, I suppose the two favourites, I guess, still would be England and Ireland?
Yeah, for sure.
But that neither of them have really kind of torn it up so far in the championship, have they? Question marks over both.
And I was really hoping that we were going to be the challenge that could help define that tournament, because I genuinely thought we had a very good chance at the weekend. And, you know, I was being a little flippant last week, but in my head, I genuinely believed we were going to go and make a mark on that game. And it was, in the end, it was as close as it could
be. But why should it be any? It shouldn't be any different next week. I mean, Ireland have lost Robbie Henshaw, who's a very influential inside centre, scored a couple of tries against Italy. Perhaps potentially more damaging, they've lost Tag Furlong to injury. Their Lions prop, who is a beast of a player. And so come the set piece, Wales have got a very decent front row, you know, that evens things up there. And you know, well, I still think Wales are dangerous. Every time I see Wales, they look dangerous in Six Nations.
And bonus points as well, of course. The fact that Wales actually took a bonus point out of Saturday, which I think kind of went unmentioned, really, in the fact.
So it did, yeah.
That could be absolutely crucial, you know, because in a tight game like that, and if we get to a situation where there's, say, three teams that have all lost one game, which is very, very feasible, then that bonus point could make all the difference.
Yeah. We do still have Italy to come.
Yeah. And you would expect to score four tries against Italy.
Yeah, you'll have a tough 60 minutes, but 20 minutes after that, you may.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you finish against Italy and France, you know, France at home, final day. So
and France could have just thrown a towel in by then. Because actually, I mean, we haven't really talked about what happened at Murrayfield. And actually, I think that the way the sort of French mentality a little bit did show that perhaps as the tournament goes on, you know, they've now lost two games on the bounce. Which is, it's astonishing, isn't it? They haven't won in seven or eight games. Yeah, what is it now? Eight games or something?
Eight games, yeah.
It's incredible. So, you know, the way they sort of disintegrated a little bit.
They turned to dust.
Yeah. Boxy's just kind of just chucking the ball around half-heartedly, just kicking hard. I mean, it was like they did throw the towel in. So that would suggest that by the time they get to the end of the tournament, you know, if they're sitting towards the bottom of the table, they are not going to come out all guns blazing against Wales.
They're going to run out of towels very soon, aren't they?
Yeah.
I would think so. I mean, I don't know how, in many ways, I don't know how France lost that game in Edinburgh. I mean, they were terrific in the first half. Admittedly, they've got this kind of one-man wrecking crew in Teddy Thomas, who's just a great finisher, but he was waved through for at least one of his tries.
Finn Russell just kind of stepped after you, Claude. You know, I mean, it was ridiculous.
Is it fitness? Are they a 60-minute side?
Possibly. I mean, I think in the case of the Thomas try, he does have exceptional acceleration over the 5 meters. So I think he has the ability to make fools of a lot of defenders, but nonetheless. You know, he put France in a very good place mentally as well as on the scoreboard. You know, they looked pretty tidy, didn't they, early on? They scored a couple of tries. You know, they've got some decent players. Some of their young back row kids, they're decent players. And yet, they allowed a Scottish team with no real confidence, with half-backs who weren't firing. They allowed them to get a toehold back in the game. And once you get Greg Laidlaw having a few pots at goal, once he gets in that mood, he could still be there now kicking them.
It was, yeah. I mean, Scotland didn't really have to do anything to win the match. No. It was the most bizarre thing. It was just penalty after penalty after penalty. And you could see them coming, you know, to the point where, don't get me wrong, I was cheering for Scotland very loudly. But, you know, you almost wanted to say, no, don't do that. You know, the guy's coming in from the side. And you could see you could see it 10 seconds in. No, where are you going? What are you doing?
I thought Paul O'Connell in commentary, he nailed it. I kind of mentioned it on Twitter at the time because it was such a great line. He said, Scotland don't need to pull a rabbit out of the hat. France are going to do it for them.
He absolutely
hit the nail on the head there. And this was at a time when the game was very much in the balance, but you could just see the way it was going. The pattern had emerged of France trying to overplay and Scotland finally, they'd taken Russell off, they'd moved Laidlaw to fly half, and just realising that actually, if we don't push this too hard, France are going to give it to us. Which, of course, is exactly what happened.
That goes into the sporting area that really, really winds me up, which is people trying not to make mistakes to win rather than trying to win. I think Andy Murray went through a period of doing this. It was knock the ball back. Don't hit a winner. Knock the ball back.
Let the opponent make a mistake.
My tennis is not dissimilar to
it
that.
It drives me nuts. Yeah. It's like, try and win.
I think, I mean,
you're right. They didn't have to push
from the Scottish perspective. I think it was more just about, you know, confidence was absolutely shattered after the Wales game. You could see that. I think you could see it in Finn Russell in particular.
Well, when they didn't have to do a lot. Yeah. I think that they did one really key thing was when Thomas scored that first try.
Yeah, responded.
And after the week they'd had, their heads could have gone down.
Yeah, yeah, completely. I won't lie. Being a Scotland fan and having seen this many, many dozens of times, I was ready to write off the match there and then. Right, okay, good, excellent. 3 minutes in, 7-0 down, brilliant. You just thought, right, here we go again. And actually, so the response was really heartening, actually. And I think that for Scotland, it was literally just about getting back on the horse, wasn't it? We got to get over the line, get the win. And then now they could start thinking about an actual game plan for the England match.
And when France scored early on, your head went down. You were standing in a pub wearing a kilt, as you always do. Were you tempted to leave and come home and change? Or?
Never. Never. No, no, absolutely not. Of course not.
At the weekend, I specifically ordered a Lee Halfpenny t-shirt to wear because I was very, very convinced that was going to be the difference. And I knew he was ill on Friday, and when you get that little message on Saturday, Halfpenny's out. But I've bought a t-shirt and everything. You can't. You've let me down, Lee. He'll be back.
Oh, God. So, Alex, as an intrepid rugby journalist, in a break week that we've got coming up, what does the week hold for you? I mean, where are you going to be? What are you going to be doing?
Well, I'm going straight from here to the Royal Garden Hotel in High Street, Kensington, of all places, where England have decamped to this week. We talked last week about how Eddie Jones likes to change things up. Never, you know, keep them guessing, keep them moving, keep changing the landscapes around them. He's done that this week. He's taken them off into the middle of town, away from the rural splendour of Pennyhill Park, where they're based.
It seems an odd place to put, you know, 30 massive blokes like pack them into central London. It seems
it's a hotel which is used by the Southern Hemisphere every autumn. So Australia and New Zealand, and occasionally South Africa, but particularly Australia and New Zealand always base themselves there. You know, it's a nice part of town. You've got the Kensington Gardens, and you've got a lot of greenery in Hyde Park down the road. And it's just Eddie Jones's argument is that he wants to keep Pennyhill Park sacred. He wants to Pennyhill Park, for those who don't know, is a lovely hotel on the outskirts of Bagshot. In which, as you drive in, to the left, England have got their own rugby pitch, state-of-the-art rugby pitch with all the bells and whistles around it. And just beyond the pitch, they built a high-performance centre there now. They'd signed this. Clive Woodward agreed this deal many years ago with Pennyhill Park. They became kind of partners with it. And so they've got this fantastic high-performance centre. They do all their work there. But Jones's view on it is that he doesn't want people getting bored with Pennyhill Park. There was a sense during the 2015 World Cup, which some of the players articulated, that they just became stir-crazy. They spent so much time there. Mm-hmm. So Jones only uses Pennyhill Park in test match weeks. So this week isn't a test match week. There's no match on Saturday or Sunday. So he takes them out of that environment, goes somewhere else where they have a completely different focus.
Makes sense.
And so that's what we've got with him this week. We're going to see him this evening. It'll be very interesting to see how he responds after the weekend, where he was very much on the front foot against the press for his perception of the way we as a group have reported Mike Brown down the years, which is slightly at odds with reality, but nonetheless he does it with such force that he gets his point across, doubtless makes Mike Brown feel good, gets everyone else talking. So it'd be interesting to see whether he just has just moved the target. Well, he would have done. You know he would have done. But what it is, we'll find out later, and we'll talk about next week, I'm sure.
So just a suggestion, if you're going to see Eddie later, if he really wants to sort of move them around and keep them on their toes, don't send them to Kensington High Street. Send them down to the Ibis on the edge of the M4 just outside Newport. We'd love to see them.
That's the place.
I'm sure they'd get loads of sleep.
Get a few boys waiting for them. We'll get a welcoming committee together.
So is there a chance that we might, if someone's walking around Hyde Park, you know, you've got tourists walking around Hyde Park next week, they might see a load of England internationals chucking a ball about in Hyde Park?
I would say it's possible. It certainly happened before, because I know either a year or 2 years ago they were spotted doing a session in Hyde Park. So it has happened before. Whether they do that, I know they use one of the kind of public schools in London. They use their playing fields at, I think, Latimer as well. But yeah, it's a definite possibility. But if you're expecting it, won't happen, because again, Jones will wrong foot.
He'll keep you on your toes.
No, you're wrong foot. Just guaranteed it won't
happen. He'll keep you on your toes. And have you got plans in terms of where you'll be? Are you just sticking with the England team essentially over the next couple of weeks, or throughout the tournament, or would you be
pretty much? Yeah, no, we stay with them. Ireland disappear. Ireland don't tend to talk to their press an awful lot at all. They've got a slightly bonkers relationship with the public, which strikes me as out of order, but that's the way they've chosen to go down the road.
Where do you think that comes from?
The head coach. Everything comes from the head coach. You know, be it Eddie Jones or be it, in Ireland's case, Joe Schmidt. You know, they will all do what they feel is right to create the right atmosphere for their own players, and they don't care what the PR side of things make of it and how positive it is. You know, Scotland. Gregor Townsend, he's very good with the people, very good with the message. Be interesting to see how he plays the next fortnight, you know, because he had a very difficult first week, a bit of redemption, you know, at Murrayfield at the weekend. So now what does he do with England and Eddie Jones? I mean, what do you want to do with him? Do you poke the bear, or do you stand back and let him just get on with it? It's going to be interesting Scotland...
I think it'll be more of the latter.
What would you do?
Well, it always strikes me that Townsend is not a particularly combative sort of bloke, is he? He's a genuinely nice guy,
yeah.
Who loves his rugby, obviously knows the game back to front. But it seems to me that whereas, you know, Joe Schmidt or Eddie Jones have that kind of, they almost seek that kind of siege mentality, don't they, in terms of getting into it with the press.
So do you let Jones walk all over you?
I don't think it's a case of letting him walk all over you. I think that you take away some of his power by not giving him the traction of his arguments or his points. You don't respond when he makes a point. You just say, that's Eddie Jones.
I think you have to go with your personality as a coach, don't you? And I don't think Townsend's got it in him necessarily. I don't think he's that sort of guy who will go toe-to-toe and slug it out with Jones. I think he will try and rise above it a little bit, I would imagine. Whether that's the right thing to do or not is a different question. But I think you can only really go with, you know, your sort of gut instinct, can't you?
But it's fascinating, isn't it? You know, whatever we think of these coaches, it's like Trump in America. You know, nobody likes him, but boy, does it make life interesting. Political life and podcasts, people talking, radio shows. You know, you've got the good versus evil narrative out there, whichever side you want to place yourself on. And rugby and the Six Nations, which is always magnificent because it's, you know, the games are always pretty much, 95% of the games are always close. You can always make a case for Wales or Scotland springing a surprise against the mother country. You know, all the historical baggage.
It does come.
It's fantastic.
And Eddie Jones does. He has. I don't know whether he's done this deliberately or not, but he has kind of lent himself to that particular Celtic narrative of the Six Nations, which is Scotland, Wales, and Ireland all despising the English rugby team. Which, let's face it, that is what drives a lot of this championship. And Jones has really embraced that. As I say, whether he's deliberately doing that because of the history or
because he is.
Yeah. Okay, well there you have it.
I mean, he genuinely, Jones, he sees part of his role to entertain along the way. Now he won't allow anything to get in his pursuit of victory, but on his own terms, he wants to entertain. He wants people talking about the championship. He does feel that responsibility. There is no doubt about that. You know, he does talk about that, as long as it doesn't get in the way of the winning business, which is, you know, what
I think
happens.
That's the question, is whether Eddie Jones as a coach, if he was a nice bloke, flat out, and just didn't take part in any of the stuff that you can think is a little distasteful or not, would he be the same winner? Does he need that element to galvanise himself, to galvanise the players, to just try to make him seem, we are a nasty machine?
I think so. And you take it back to football again, don't you? You know, I mean, you don't
How many people love Mourinho? How many people hate Mourinho? There's a lot of stuff that Mourinho does that you wouldn't like. It's really interesting that you say that Jones is a fan of Mourinho and Conte. Conte's another very spiky, edgy personality.
Yeah.
Very intense.
Yeah.
Likely to sort of erupt at any moment. Sure. It's interesting that he takes football coaches. Why do you think that is? What do you think that he's...
Because I think, as we talked about before, I think that is the template that he has for coaching. You know, he not only are they all accomplished coaches, but they see the kind of the mental side of it and the messages they put across. They see that so intrinsic to the result which is achieved at the weekend. It's not just about getting players who can pass flat in the face of traffic, who can win the lineouts, do the set piece well. They've got to have that mental kind of fortitude about them, and that bit of devil in them. You know, Jones is full of devil. He's full of devil. You know, he'll say the right things at the right time, but everything he does, we start repeating ourselves now, but everything he does is designed for his team to achieve off the back of it. And he sees the way that Mourinho manufactures situations at times. The way that Conte has played things very cleverly at times, less so at the moment, admittedly, but particularly last season, he played the dynamics with Mourinho very well indeed, didn't he? And he admires all that. He loves it. You know, he spends a lot of time watching Match of the Day when he's at home. He watches all the rugby games, all the Premiership rugby. He goes to three matches a weekend, and then he watches all the rest of the games in full on TV. But he also never misses Match of the Day. Loves his Match of the Day. And you talk to him about it, it's not just the highlights. He loves the post-match interviews. He sits there watching the way Mourinho tackles certain questions, the way that Klopp comes in with that kind of great levity, laughter and enthusiasm, but then is also able on occasions to turn things around. And, you know, he will talk about how he learns from all these people all the time. I think increasingly people within football as well as other sports are learning from Jones. But he will never accept that he's the master of all these things. He will say he is still learning. So fascinating. It takes him, whether it ultimately it leads to, as in football, managers who can only achieve on a fairly short-term basis. Mourinho's never really achieved over a long period at a club, has he? And the big question with Jones, particularly when he signed his contract extension, is can this brand of coaching management, man management, sustain over the longer period? And that is a question without an answer at the moment, because he hasn't gone that length of time. But I think while he's doing it, while we're on the ride, we've just got to enjoy it and be intrigued as to where the end game is.
That seems as good a note as any on which to end this, because we've been talking for quite some time. So, but all very interesting stuff. I like the idea of Eddie Jones as the Mourinho of rugby. I think we've just found our next headline.
Is he a Man United fan?
Don't think so. No, that's a good question. No, I don't know the
there
answer.
There you go, one for him later when you see him.
We'll find that out.
Find out, yeah, there you go. There's another story. Right, well, look, thanks as ever for tuning in and listening. I'm hoping that you're learning something from Alex's various insights here. Please stick with us. We'll be back every week throughout the rest of the tournament. Subscribe to the podcast if you haven't. Leave us a nice review if you would. That'd be much appreciated. We'll see you again next week. Cheers.